Gallatin Valley and online listeners, you are listening to KGVM, Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. Well, we've got Teddy Wilson on the piano and Billie Holiday to put us in the mood today. Here's a quote for you. Who will protect the wilderness and public lands, our national parks and monuments, our nature preserves and conservation areas, our wild rivers and mountains and forests? As the nation slips into chaos and decline, we are going to have to take over the stewardship of lands and preserves that will have to survive not just this government, but all future governments of whatever sort. Did that sound timely? Well, it's from February 1st, 2019, and it's the intro to our episode of Desert Oracle Radio tonight titled The Holy Rangers. We'll also be talking about topics of love and fascination in the second half of the show, but now, here is The Holy Rangers.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on our beloved desert. Our landscape of mystery, the place without enough water for people. And yet here we are, preparing the species for the inevitable gloomy colonies on Mars. The Mars colonies will probably be something like airports, inside the airports, I mean, the terminals. There will be no outside, not for you. Not yet. Maybe after we terraform Mars, after many centuries of lawsuits. Meanwhile, for the rest of your life, and probably for the rest of my life, probably the lives of our children, Mars Colony 1 will be much like an airport terminal, probably like the Tom Bradley International Terminal in Los Angeles. A few places to spend money and no going outside, ever. Of course, the billionaire class will be able to go outside in custom luxury branded Martian safari vehicles and spacesuits by Goop. Have your financial advisor contact our concierge for scheduling. Influencers with followings of at least 50 million Earth humans of the proper demographics will be invited for live-streamed ride-alongs on a case-by-case basis. If you would rather not have an influencer on your Martian safari, please have your law firm prepare the necessary paperwork before your non-refundable deposit is accepted. If it turned out that I had $1 billion sitting around, I think I'd want to stay as quiet as possible. I think I would want to stay out of the news cycle right about now. But one of these guys, one of these characters, announced that he'd like to buy the presidency. In once one of these guys who got very, 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 very rich selling beverages to people in strip malls. And this guy sort of looked around the emerging political landscape and he thought, well, why don't I try to buy this? It worked out pretty well the last time somebody did that. Sure, you have these kids out there talking about how they want to have some kind of health care when they're sick and depressed and dying. Well, if I ever found a surprising amount of money attached to my name, the first thing I would do is not run for president, but head out for a month or two in the desert wilderness in the wintertime in a little one-room cabin full of books and wine and maybe some board games in case somebody found the place and wanted to play chess or something, Scrabble or Battleship. And at night after grilling my supper on the fire, well, I'd stretch out under the stars and watch for satellites, for meteor storms, especially for things that I don't understand or recognize at all. Weird lights and strange creatures. And no noise from the road. Why do we assume the weird lights and strange creatures and other such things that appear and then vanish are related to the systems, maybe other galaxies? It's not the kind of thing people really even considered before about a century and a half ago. And really building up after the publication of H.G. Wells' The War of the Worlds in 1897. An earlier panic, an earlier global outrage as the new higher-powered Earth telescopes had revealed mysterious new details on the surface of Mars. New details that to a lot of people looked like waterways and canals. That's when we started worrying about the Martians. After 1877, when the Italian astronomer Giovanni Schiaparelli described and even named the mysterious canals he saw through his telescope. Was there an ancient civilization on Mars, maybe living underground now? We still do not know the answer to those questions. But the things that appeared to be canals are now thought to be a sort of optical illusion that led the astronomer to do what people often do. Attempt to make order out of random appearances of lines and shadow. Order from chaos. The way we do when we look at the clouds. The way we do when we look at the boulders out here in the desert. There are boulders that look like monsters. There are boulders that look like comic book characters, like elephants, like jowly old plutocrats. You know, we call them plutocrats because back in ancient Rome, Pluto was both the god of hell and the god of money, which makes sense when you think about it. So the worshippers of money were known as the worshippers of Pluto, of death. Our beloved desert, like the rest of our nation's wilderness, natural monuments, and national parks, was left to fend for itself after so many decades of ostensibly being under the care and control of the United States Department of the Interior. Off-roaders rivers cut into a bunch of protected national park here, leaving many miles of newly chewed up desert landscape. And people, having their biological needs, also left great piles of human waste all over the national park because most of the toilets were locked up. Some people did bad things because that is their meager identity, acting like garbage instead of acting like humans who have some self-respect, who have a basic understanding of things. The land conservationists were very upset, politely, of course, and the National Park Service staff had to deal with more than a month off work with pay held back. And what a nightmare that was for the good people who decided they would make a career out of taking care of America's most prized and beautiful lands. What happened over the winter holidays now seems likely to happen again in the coming weeks, and again after that, because we are in a part of history familiar to those who are familiar with Gibbon's decline and fall of the Roman Empire. In that great study of imperial collapse, traumatic events are few and far between. For every barbarian sack of Rome, there are many years of simple decline. Roads no longer maintained, public parks and gardens left to decay and abuse, literacy and culture fading, the trust in public safety falls, the rich growing ever dumber and meaner as they retreat from civil society, etc., etc. So what shall we do about it? Civilizations do rise and they do fall. That's just how it goes. Only a dumb fool would look at this country today and say, well, things seem to be going well. America is a thriving and rising civilization. Only a fool would say that because only an utter fool would believe it. Or like the greatly overpaid New York news anchors on that propaganda cable channel, only a well-paid and utterly cynical millionaire would say such a thing when paid good money to do so, despite knowing deep in his or her shriveled little heart that we are at the end of one historic cycle. And that will work itself out for good or ill. What will not work itself out is the protection of our public lands, our national parks and monuments, our nature preserves and conservation areas, our wild rivers and mountains and forests. We are going to have to take over that duty. There's no time to expand upon all of this, not tonight, as I am late as usual, busy, chasing a very small amount of dollars in a smaller amount of time. That's the business plan of a small town publisher and broadcaster in our dingbat year of 2019. But the time shall soon come, as St. Paul wrote, to put aside childish things, put aside cooperation with a society of adult children. What I'm talking about is this. Every natural park and preserve is going to need a team of people who take a vow, maybe for a year or two, like in the Peace Corps, AmeriCorps, maybe for a decade, maybe for their working life, maybe like a Buddhist monk or a Catholic worker for life. Now, many people are looking for a meaningful life from here on out, being on the right side of the great cultural war, the right side that will win if any side wins, because the other side is death. The slow death of a miserable species that killed itself off while killing off the only planet it ever had. Now imagine a common house with public spaces right up against the park or preserve in question. Private land owned by the nonprofit organization, the state or national organization, running under simple and basic rules that can and should always be adapted for the particular bioregion. always adapted for the particular human culture, the society of humans who choose to get off the sinking luxury liner of 21st century exploitation and misery and all the rotten extremes and excesses of late capitalism. All of those who choose to get off the burning boat full of vampire rats and take a stand on the land. Now, these recruits may be part-timers from the community, the sort of lay people who came to the rescue as best they could when their friendly neighborhood national park was abandoned by a vicious and idiotic government, a government of vipers, of scam artists, con men, slobs, sex creeps. And working aside with these good people are those who have taken the vows. Who live at the Great Lodge, the Temple of the Sun, the home on the range. There is always lots of good and interesting work to do, and it can be done anywhere it needs to be done, but when there's trouble, when the state parks close, as they did in California a decade ago, or when the national parks and monuments are abandoned to chaos and lawlessness as they were last month and surely will be again, well, then the world shall see why these earth keepers, these holy rangers, have made the commitment they have made. They will spring into action, keeping ne'er-do-wells out of the natural parks, helping tourists and travelers find clean and safe places to camp or lodge, rescuing toddlers from sand dunes and Joshua trees from Instagrammers. And when the systems break down in whatever government and whatever capital, whether affecting a wildlife preserve in Africa or a desert national park in California, we shall not need to weep and moan, and we shall not engage in the gnashing of teeth, which is particularly bad for your molars. We shall not mourn the things that have passed on, for we have a new covenant. We have a purpose and strategy. Now, this is going to require a lot of philanthropy, which is a nice word for hand it over yourself before the masses are compelled to take it back. We're going to need to buy interesting and functional buildings on good land that hasn't been scraped and wrecked. Maybe that Sacred Sands house out on Quail Springs, that's for sale. Well, the organization is going to need to get organized and collect the donations from the plutocrats, and maybe we'll get it started right here in the high desert of California. I've got a lot of material I've collected or collated or typed up myself over the past decade or so of economic chaos and climate catastrophe, and one thing you don't hear too much on the news is that land preserves and national parks and state forests and any kind of protected land is crucial as a carbon sink. All those plants from the big Joshua trees and the junipers and the yuccas and the pinyons to the microbiotic desert crust you can barely see until it's been torn up and turned into lifeless sand. All those plants, great and small, all those plants hold the same carbon we hope to hold in such places rather than letting it fill up our atmosphere and kill us all. Because that's the end game. That is the final play. Only in this new century have scientists begun to explore just how much of a carbon sink our deserts are. That it's not just the big obvious wild forests that both hold carbon and breathe oxygen back into our atmosphere in immense amounts. Well, here's something enjoyable to report. Thanks to lobbying efforts from our friend Jeremy Corbell, he of the UFO documentaries you can watch on your home television, look him up. Documentaries about Bob Lazar, the alleged Area 51 whistleblower, on a very weird place called Skinwalker Ranch. Well, anyway, I wound up on Coast to Coast AM last week with George Knapp and had a nice weird conversation about some of the odd tales that come from our desert lands. And I received some interesting emails following that appearance, and I thought I would answer a few of those on the air tonight. Mr. Lane, I am certain many other Coast to Coast listeners greatly enjoyed your visit with George Knapp. I've not traveled through your part of the West, but will certainly put it on my travel list for the next time I motorcycle westward. I agree with you and George that deserts are special places. Most of my desert experience has been in New Mexico, Utah, and Nevada. I almost made it to Death Valley once, but the Nevada Highway Patrol had other ideas. Oh well. Again, thank you for an interesting and entertaining interview, and please do come back. Signed, Iron Pig. Well, thank you for that, and I hope you get out here to the Mojave while the weather's still good, which should be for another couple of weeks. And then we'll try again around Christmas time, as usual. Now, I was driving through the Las Vegas suburbs not long ago, past one marijuana shop after another, and I was thinking about how when I was a kid, Nevada would put you in prison for life if they caught you selling marijuana. Things do change, but the traffic cops in Nevada do still pay special attention to out-of-state plates. I should have kept my old Silver State plates from the old Jeep, just for such occasions. Now here's one that got me digging into old UFO reports, which is one of my favorite hobbies. Just sifting through these mysterious reports from eyewitnesses generally unknown to us. You get the date and the place and the time and the statement, and that's about it. Maybe an intriguing sketch. This one is very interesting for me because it's a good reminder that whatever I think I might know about a situation because I read a couple of newspaper articles about it or because I heard something on a podcast or on the radio, I probably don't really know all that much about it at all. Here's the letter. My ears perked up last night when I heard you on Coast to Coast mention that there were a lot of UFO sightings reported after the Northridge earthquake. However, you seem to dismiss these as being made by people who would not know a star from a UFO. I saw something the evening after the initial quake, and it wasn't stars. I was in our parked car on the west side of the street across from our home in Sherman Oaks, California. If you've ever been out to the San Fernando Valley, you know where Ventura Boulevard is located. I live a couple of streets north of it, a few doors from the Los Angeles River. South of Ventura Boulevard, there are hills. It was above these hills that I saw a formation of lights. At first, I thought they might be helicopters. But they were all perfectly still in the sky, southwest of where I was. They simply remained there for a few minutes, and then suddenly they all moved together at a sideways angle and were gone. They disappeared instantly. These were not helicopters, unless perhaps the military has aircraft that can move like that. I've observed meteor showers before, and this was nothing to do with meteors. Many areas had lost power, so there was not as much artificial light that could hinder the view of the sky. One other thing I would like to mention is that someone else saw something very similar after the Northridge earthquake. A woman I know who lived in the hills at the opposite side of the valley also saw these lights in the sky above her home. I did not learn of her experience until several weeks after the earthquake. yet she described the same thing that I had seen. If you have any record of the many UFO sightings reported after the Northridge earthquake, would you please share them with me? I very much would like to see if the reports matched what I had experienced. A few years ago, I did report my sighting to MUFON. Sincerely, S.G. Well, thanks for your letter, and if anyone listening tonight had a similar experience following the Northridge quake of 1994, let us know and we'll let SG know. I had heard that Northridge blackout story so many times, I even heard an astronomer repeat it on a public radio station some years ago now. And I honestly had not given much thought to the idea that there were UFO sightings happening during that same night of terror and starlight. So I searched MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, and the only report they've got from that night sounds like the one SG filed. But they really don't have much online from before the online era. Our wonderful era of online garbage and not nearly enough useful information. The National UFO Reporting Center has a single report from that night of a fireball after the quake. And there's a very weird book about Topanga Canyon UFO sightings that talks about that night. Again, not much to be found online from the pre-World Wide Web era. Although there are many thousands of reports and file cabinets somewhere. And the owner of a rare bookstore up in Utah recently bought the contents of an entire storage space in Arizona, and the whole thing was filled with UFO books and all kinds of files and clippings. Be nice to have this stuff in a research library somewhere. Nasty note, too, from somebody back east who was personally offended because a couple of people on the radio were talking about the desert they know and love. And all I can say is that if you don't like the desert, if you simply don't care for this climate and environment, well, you sure don't have to come out here. The less people, the better. Last night in Palm Springs, we had the last of the scheduled Desert Oracle campfire stories over at the Ace Hotel, and of course it was pouring down rain, as happens every couple of years, whether we need it or not, and the campfire stories got rained out, and they put me in the bar by the DJ turntables, and well, it just wasn't quite the same thing. I appreciate everybody who came out. It was nice talking to all of you. And we'll try to do this around the fire again before too long. We do have some other events. The first of those being a night of Strange Desert Stories by your host, Ken Lane, at the beautiful old Schoolhouse Museum just across the road from the Inn at 29 Palms. Let me just read from the press release here. Sponsored by the Desert Institute, Joshua Tree National Park, and the 29 Palms Historical Society, this lecture is held at the old Schoolhouse Museum, 6760 National Park Drive, 29 Palms, on Friday, February 8th at 7 p.m. This lecture is open to the public and costs $5 per person at the door. Optional dinner with the presenter, whoever he is, at 5 p.m. at the 29 Palms Inn. Dinner reservations are limited, so please RSVP by calling 760-367-5539 before Wednesday, February 4. That information is also on our website, desertoracle.com, and our various social media accounts until I delete them. Or you can write to us at radio@desertoracle.com. This is Desert Oracle, broadcasting from Joshua Tree, California, Fridays at 10 p.m. across the Mojave on KCDZ 107.7 FM from Amboy to Zizix, and good night from the voice of the desert.
It's the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay on KGBM 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio. Have you been able to see the sky on a clear night recently? Well, according to NASA, on February 9th, you can find the nearly full moon in the east after dark, about three finger widths below reddish Mars. Bright stars Pollux and Castor in Gemini are just to its north. And on February 12th, we have the full moon, and that's also Lincoln's birthday. As the midwinter moon, or the second full moon of winter, some Native American tribes of what is now the northern and eastern United States called this the snow moon or the hunger moon. It was known as the snow moon because of the heavy snows that fall in this season, and bad weather and heavy snows made hunting difficult, so this moon was also called the hunger moon. And I've also heard that it was called the bear moon because this is when the bears have their babies. But, oh, that full moon. Thinking about all things romantic and all things about attraction, I found this on LiveScience.com. On Valentine's Day, lovers who are eager to woo their partners show their affection with traditional gifts of red roses, heart-shaped boxes of chocolates, or with romantic dinners in fancy restaurants. There's usually some effort involved, but pulling off a memorable Valentine's Day is easier and generally safer than some of the courtship rituals performed by other animal species. For most animals, wooing comes with heightened personal risk. A male's showy displays, while attracting a female's attention, could also attract nearby predators and fights between male rivals, which can also result in a date night with a body count. In some cases, winning a cannibalistic female's affections places the male at the top of the post-coital menu. Many of the courting behaviors practiced by animals may seem strange to us, but as peculiar and risky as they are, they work just fine for their intended audiences. Here are just a few examples of unusual and extreme courtship rituals in the animal kingdom, and I will add these are ones that I picked because these animals can be found in Montana. So the first one is land snails. As land snails are hermaphrodites, either snail in a mating pair is capable of fertilizing the other, and both are equipped with love darts that they use to stab their partner after they spend a bit of time circling around and touching each other with their muscular pseudopods. Some snail species shoot single darts, some shoot multiple darts, and others use a single dart to repeatedly jab their mate for close to an hour, according to a 2006 study published in the journal The American Naturalist.
Whoa. this thing called love, this funny thing called love. Just who can solve its mystery?
Little is known about dinosaurs' mating habits, but evidence preserved in rocks in Colorado suggests that some dinosaurs practiced a ritual dance much like one performed by living birds. Paleontologists found scrape marks, many dozens of them, in four sites that held remains of Cretaceous dinosaurs. In a 2016 study published in the journal Nature Scientific Reports, researchers explained that they saw distinct similarities between these scratches in the rock and so-called nest scrapes created by certain types of male birds as part of their courtship displays. Male birds across a number of ground nesting species, including sage grouse, puffins, and various shorebirds, scrape the ground in front of females as if to demonstrate how good they would be at building a nest. They make dozens or even hundreds of scratches at a time and usually accompany scraping with strutting, puffing themselves up, and fanning their tails. Black widow females are about twice as large as males, so the smaller suitors have to take some precautions when approaching a female's web, lest they be mistaken for prey and eaten before mating even gets underway. Males stay safe by announcing their presence to the female with vigorous rump shaking. As a male steps onto a female's web, he vibrates his abdomen, sending signals coursing along the silk strands. He advances, vibrates, and pauses, advances, vibrates, and pauses, a pattern distinctly different from the shorter, more irregular movements of trapped prey, researchers found in a study published in the journal Frontiers in Zoology. The study authors also discovered that the vibrations that males produce are at a low amplitude, further distinguishing them from prey movements, which were more dynamic and percussive.
The same old story, it's as old as the stars above. The same old story of a boy and a girl.
Male mice, seeking to impress a mate, sing unique, high-pitched songs, vocalizing in the ultrasonic range. They produce these whistling sounds, which differ greatly from normal communication, by creating a type of feedback loop of airflow in the windpipe and larynx, according to a 2016 study published in the journal Current Biology. Scientists discovered the mechanism by shooting high-speed video of the mice's larynxes as they vocalized, capturing 100,000 frames per second. Impressive though this technique may be, female mice are picky about which songs they like. They prefer tunes that differ from those sung by their relatives, according to an earlier study published in February 2014 in the journal PLOS-1. Male North American porcupines must go to great lengths to secure the affections of females, which only go into estrus once a year for 8 to 12 hours. Prior to ovulating, the female secretes a fragrant, to a porcupine, vaginal mucus that lures males closer. the lucky male that finds her and manages to chase away any rivals stimulates ovulation by drenching her in an explosive jet of urine, described as a high-speed projectile by porcupine expert Uldis Rose, author of The North American Porcupine, from Comstock Publishing Associates, 2009, and Porcupines, The Animal Answer Guide, published by Johns Hopkins University Press, 2012. Body parts that reflect ultraviolet light help male jumping spiders in the Cosmophasis umbratica species catch females' eyes, all eight of them. Males lure the female spiders by striking poses that display these glowing patches prominently. However, female spiders of the species have a glowing trick of their own, possessing palps, a pair of appendages near the head that fluoresce green in ultraviolet light, which they use to attract the males. Both male and female spiders rely on these signals to tell who's in a mating mood, scientists discovered in a 2007 study published in the journal Science. When ultraviolet light was blocked and the spiders didn't glow, they lost interest in mating, the researchers found. All this focus this time of year on love has me pondering many kinds of love. I mean, there's love between friends and between people and their pets and between members of a family, right? But does love have a shape? Does the earth love its creatures? I talked with my poet friend, Kelly Madigan, recently, and she shared this poem for us.
The coyotes here know us, and we keep their secrets, their den sites unrevealed. We differentiate between active and ancient burrows easily. Look for tracks since last rain, or a draped doorway of spiderweb. The local bulletin board sports a notice from a guy looking for landowners who will allow him to hunt. Says, not many get away. Sees their presence as a problem to be solved. We know that coyotes refill like groundwater, react to losses with giant litters, more pups to counteract the population decline. Remove a coyote, and another coyote appears. Remove a pack, and a new pack takes its place. There is a space inside of me the size and shape of my grandmother. When she died, it filled in with love of grandmother. Whatever she was, she is this now. Memory wears her thick glasses, cradles her story of clutching fresh raspberries in toddler hands, of her life being saved by mud after disturbing the bees. My father lives in a similar memory purse, his money talk, his rocket launch, his moonrise. This is the way of coyotes. You could kill them all, eradicate the species, and still, more pups would spill out into the landscape. Consider it a seed bank. There is a coyote-shaped place that can only be filled with coyote. The hillside itself manufactures them. It will not be stopped by your short-term efforts. Build a neighborhood, and they will eat the birdseed and cat food you put out. Build a city, and they will shop at your grocery, ride your subway. Build a religion, and coyote curls up in your manger. You might listen to them and mistake it for laughter, but it is an unending song of mending, of recovery. The local guy is frustrated. Landowners don't take him up on his eradication offer. It's like he is offering to bail water out of the river. The river knows where it belongs and refreshes.
I'm not the gifted poet that Kelly Madigan is, but here are the nature readings for this week from Nature, A Day at a Time, from author, illustrator, and naturalist Kathy Katz. And the reading for February 9th is Prairie Dogs, or Cinnamus, were named for their dog-like bark. They are members of the squirrel family and live in lonely, dry, brushy areas. In their isolated prairies, these rodents are extremely sociable, with complex traditions and behaviors, and they show signs of affection by grooming, touching faces, tumbling, and fondling family members and neighbors. The chemicals exchanged from kissing are a way to transfer information between prairie dogs. And then it closes with a quote from Chico Marx. He said, "I wasn't kissing her, I was just whispering in her mouth." And that's from the Marx Brothers scrapbook by Groucho Marx and Richard J. Annobile. February 10th. A prairie dog colony offers protection from dozens of stalking predators. Their complex language of thumps, barks, and body gestures relays information from specific events nearby. Approaching hawk, or big human hunting, or coyote to the west. Their social system is regimented by structure and rules, such as the movement of the very old and the very young to the fringes of a colony. Prairie dogs learn and practice skills such as diving quickly into their tunnel openings to prepare for inevitable threats to their safety. Despite the time spent guarding their communities, prairie dogs spend hours at play each day. And it closes with a quote from Ted Andrews in Animal Speak. And he says, "No other animal, except for perhaps the wolf, epitomizes the idea of community more than the prairie dog. A prairie dog community is always filled with activity." And finally, there are a couple events I wanted to tell you about this week. First off, on February 11th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the MAP Brewing Company in Bozeman, it is the Native Plant Society Trivia Night. This is put on by Montana Native Plant Society. And they're saying, grab a pint, test and expand your plant knowledge, and learn about the Montana Native Plant Society. Beginners and experts, welcome. And then on Wednesday, February 12th at 6:30 p.m. at the Bozeman Public Library in the community room, there's going to be a presentation with Beth Madden, wildlife biologist. And the presentation is Grasslands, Our Least Known and Most Threatened Ecosystem. And if you don't want to be there in person and you want to stream the event online, you can go to GallatinValleyEarthDay.org. And that's all one word, GallatinValleyEarthDay.org. And that event, if you look under the events, you'll see where there's a place there where you can register to stream it online. Well, my thanks first off to Teddy Wilson and Billie Holiday for their music today. And of course, thanks to Ken Lane and Red, Blue, Black, Silver for sharing their work on Desert Oracle Radio. Thank you, Callie Madigan, Kathy Katz, LiveScience.com. And thank you for listening. Thanks to KGBM and its supporters. If you want to reach me, the number is 406-404-6246. And remember, you can hear this program live on the air at 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgvm.org at 7 Sunday nights and 9 Monday mornings. Our past shows are also available on demand on the kgvm.org website. I'll be back next week with more desert and mountain lore for you. Till then, stay well and sweet dreams. And okay, Valentine's Day is all about love, right? And I think loving yourself in a healthy way is vital. You know, showing yourself respect, standing up to those situations that try to make you lose your belief in yourself is pretty important if you ask me. So on that note, here are the new respects. They're taking us out with their song, Trouble, from their album, Before the Sun Goes Down. See you next week.
Trouble, don't you find no home by me? Trouble, don't you find no home by me? Oh, my Lord, if you're listening, tell them go ahead and get gone.
Cause if you get the best, you will never be